WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
After spending 5 years as the New York Times Cairo bureau chief, Neil McFarquhar is starting a new beat covering Muslims in America. He worked as a reporter in the Arab world for more than 12 years. His new satirical novel, The Sand Cafe, is based on his experiences in 1991, covering the Gulf War from Dhahran, Saudi Arabia, for the Associated Press.
What's one of the more absurd or ridiculous parts of reporting on the Gulf War that you weren't able to actually put in print at the time that you were reporting, but you were able to describe as fiction in your novel?
Personally, as a reporter, I'm a little bit adverse to reporting about the press, but I think there is some interest on the part of readers or TV viewers about how reporters get the story, and the events that are portrayed in the Sand Cafe kind of highlight the absurdity of the situation in Dhahran during the lead-up to the Gulf War, because basically, there were 1,000 reporters there, and there were 190 rooms in the hotel, and there were 100 slots initially on the combat pool. So it was basically 1,000 reporters vying for 100 slots, although they expanded that later. And I think what I try and bring out in the Sand Cafe is just sort of the ridiculous array of reporters that ended up there. You know, one of the women's fashion magazines had sent a lesbian poet who ran around in black leather and, you know, was asking troops whether they brought sex toys along with them. And there was somebody from Audubon magazine, because Saddam had opened the oil spigots and all the cormorants were soaked in oil, what we used to call the dirty bird stories. And there was somebody from Soldier of Fortune magazine. And it just seemed like every publication on earth had a reporter in that hotel. And obviously, the complaints about access were written about at the time, but you really, in the stories, couldn't get the full absurdity of having so many different kinds of reporters under one roof, all battling for very limited access.
How did your experiences covering the Gulf War affect how you see coverage now of Iraq?
I think the military has been trying to evolve its own coverage. So, as I said, there were initially 100 combat slots during the Gulf War, and that was eventually expanded to about 160, I think. And the number of embedded reporters at the beginning of this war was 500 to 600. But the problems that you see in the Sand Cafe in reporting events in the first Gulf War also carried over into the Iraq War, because the Scud attacks and all the things that could be reported from the hotel become much more important. And that also happened in real life, of course, in Dhahran, because everyone had access to the Scud attacks. And even though they wouldn't change the course of the war one iota, that was what became the nightly news or the main headline. And I think with the embedding during the Iraq War, yes, you got intensive personal stories about what the soldiers were doing, but they tend to be exaggerated slightly. I mean, if we take the Jessica Lynch story, it was a moving human drama and obviously news. But events like that sort of get blown up out of proportion because news organizations devote so many resources to getting their reporters embedded. And so the focus becomes what's happening around their reporter. And I think you lose some of the larger picture. And certainly in Iraq, while it was a very difficult reporting experience, you didn't get the sense of any kind of stirring among the Iraqis or any resistance among the Iraqis to the American presence. And I think that, you know, the march to Baghdad became this sort of glorious victory, which really had nothing to do in the end with, you know, the terrible, bloody consequences of toppling that government.
Neil, in March of 2005, you wrote that elections and events in the Middle East, in Lebanon and Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the Palestinian territories, Iraq, have all combined to give the sense, however tentative, that twilight might be descending on authoritarian Arab government. A combination of outside pressure and internal shifts has merged to create this moment. Arabs of a younger, more savvy generation appear more willing to take their dissatisfaction directly to the front stoop of repressive leaders. Still feel that way?
A little less, I guess. There was a combination of events there that seemed like it was coming together to really push for change. But I think a number of events have changed that. First of all, the continuation of bloodshed in Iraq. And I think one of the things that's striking about coming back to the United States after so many years in the Middle East is you can't turn around over there without having some sense that, you know, there's a war in the region and a big war. You turn on the TV and it's the first headline and, people are talking about it in coffee shops. And, because I'm an American and you can't see me, but I'm 6'4" and I have blonde hair, so I look like an American. So I'm accosted on the street about the war when I talk to people. And it's just part of the everyday vocabulary in a way that it is not here. And I think that's really kind of soured people on democracy, because the United States, to a certain extent, sold the war in the region as, you know, this is going to be the end of despots and force everyone to change. And there was certainly some initial push toward that. I mean, the fact that the United States sent its army in there to topple a dictator gave all the other leaders in the region pause. But a number of things have changed that. I mean, because the leaders can point to Iraq and say, you want democracy, that's what it is. And since there's no experience with democracy in the region, people fear that any change really will descend into the kind of bloodshed that they see every day.
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Neil McFarquhar. You were the Times Cairo bureau chief for 5 years. In the last election in Egypt in 2005, the Muslim Brotherhood, which is an Islamist group, did very well. And it was the freest election in 50 years. How much power does this group actually have now?
Well, there is a parliament in Egypt. It's kind of a rubber stamp parliament. And most of the power in Egypt lies with President Mubarak. But in capturing between a fifth and a quarter of the seat, there's 444 seats in parliament, and the Muslim Brothers got almost 100. That gives them a huge voice to press for change and, to try and embarrass the National Democratic Party. And it gives them kind of a stick to poke the government with, which is one reason I think that the government of Hosni Mubarak has delayed municipal elections, because they're worried about that growing power and growing visibility of the Muslim Brothers.
What does the Muslim Brotherhood want? Its slogan is Islam is the solution. What's the agenda?
And that slogan is what gives people pause, because it can be anything, because the solution for what? And I think when you talk to people on the street, they just want a sense that someone's listening. And the Muslim Brotherhood does that very well. I followed one candidate in a very poor quarter in Alexandria, and people voted for him because he'd gotten the streets paved, he'd gotten the garbage collected, and he was seen as uncorrupt. Whereas the government candidate was kind of a rich businessman who was perfectly nice, but, he'd never been in the neighborhood before. And I think the most telling interview I had was an engineer came up to me after the rally, and he said, yes, I'm religious, and yes, I believe in the agenda of the Muslim Brotherhood, but I'm not voting for them because I want another form of despotism. I'm not voting for them because I want the religious system to replace the system of Hosni Mubarak. I'm voting for them because I want change and I want a good system so that if they turn out to be bums, I can throw them out. And I think that's the appeal of the Muslim Brotherhood, is that they are seen as the best chance for real change. But of course, it's a gamble, because people are worried that, in the end, that they will seize power and not let real democracy unfold.
If you're just joining us, my guest is New York Times reporter Neil McFarquhar, and he's just written a new satirical novel based on his experiences covering the Gulf War in 1991, and it's called The Sand Cafe. You've survived a lot of things in your time as a reporter, but you were nearly killed on a bicycle in Manhattan in 1997. What happened?
Well, I fortunately or unfortunately don't remember it. My memory consists of being on my bicycle on Fifth Avenue one minute and the next being on a stretcher being run through a corridor, just seeing the fluorescent lights overhead flash by, but not really knowing where I was. What basically happened was I was riding my bike down Fifth Avenue, and bus driver had an epileptic seizure and fell over the wheel, and the bus kept going, and it knocked me off my bicycle.
Wow. What was the damage that was done to you?
I was in a coma for about 10 days, and I was in the hospital for about 4 months. I lost a kidney, and I lost my left hip, and about 20% of the nerves in my leg. And I was in a wheelchair for 8 months, and then took about 2 years to get off a cane. But, you know, one of my doctors said to me, you know, you got really banged up, but you had a bit of luck. And part of that luck is he hit me on 28th Street and 5th Avenue and 1st Avenue. And 28th Street is the entrance to Bellevue Emergency Room. So I got it to one of the best trauma teams in the country within half an hour or so. And they basically saved my life.
Are you still dealing with a lot of pain?
It's, you know, I mean, there's certain things I can't do, long car trips, long airplane rides, things like that. But, you know, I went to Iraq and I felt comfortable reporting there. I mean, there are limits to the amount of danger I can face just because, as the doctor said, you're missing too many body parts already to lose any more. But, you know, it's all manageable.
How has this changed your sense of what a sensible risk is? Because again, you know, you've covered war. You've been in really dangerous parts of the world, and you came out unscratched. And then on Fifth Avenue, you got really terribly hurt in an accident, a driver with an epileptic seizure. So what has that done to your sense of measuring risk in a reasonable way?
You take less, obviously, because, you know that the it's funny because when you've been through great pain, you think, well, you know, it inures you to it, but it doesn't. It makes you much more hesitant. So knowing what you've been through, it's like, okay, I'm not going to go through anything that puts me into that level of trauma again. At the same time, you also, though, you empathize with people who are going through trauma much, much more. You know, because when you see the victims of accidents and you see the victims of bombings and things like that, I don't know, it just puts your emotions much more closer to the surface. But I think you get much more level-headed just about assessing what stories you can and cannot do. And there's some, you know, I mean, I think Iraq is an incredibly interesting story, but I just have to accept the fact that I personally can't do it.
So you became the Cairo bureau chief after recovering from your injuries?
Yes.
And you felt well enough to go abroad and do that?
I was fine. I felt like I had enough mobility. I talked to my surgeons about it, and they said, you know, just don't put yourself in a situation where you're going to get a blood infection, because that will cause you terrible problems with all the metal in you. The wonder of email, I would send an email to my doctor. I'm saying, you know, I'm in Baghdad and there's car bombs going off. What do you think? And I get back usually cryptic one-liner like, perhaps a more stable environment would be better.
Your new beat for the New York Times, which you're starting right now, is covering Muslims in North America. This is a weird question, but you speak Arabic. Are you ever like in a taxi or at a food stand or someplace in New York or California where somebody's having, say, like a cell phone call or a conversation that they assume you don't understand, but you do understand? As a reporter covering Muslims in America, do you learn things overhearing conversations that people don't think you understand?
I haven't done it. I just came back from the Middle East about 6 weeks ago, so I haven't really started reporting yet. So that hasn't happened yet. But it happened in Baghdad a lot, in like the Ministry of Information offices and things like that.
What did you get overhearing in the Ministry of Information office?
You know, we were always watched in Baghdad, and there were so many reporters right before the war. In the week before the war, they brought in a bunch of new minders, and the head of the press office yelled at one of the new minders, and he was waving a piece of paper at him, and he said, "You call this a report? You didn't even say who these reporters interviewed. We need much more about what they did every day."
Great. That must have inspired a lot of confidence.
Yeah, to sort of confirm what we had always feared or knew.
Well, Neil McFarquhar, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Neil McFarquhar is a reporter for the New York Times and author of the new satirical novel, The Sand Cafe, based on his experiences covering the Gulf War.